Benefits Data Trust exists to help connect people who are eligible for benefits, but left to their own devices or not able to apply and navigate the system to those programs. And we also work with public servants and others across the country to help make those systems overall, which represent billions and billions of dollars of spending, make them more efficient, more dignified, more effective, and ensure that our investment in the social safety net can not only improve individual lives, but collectively can make the country stronger, our community stronger because of better outcomes.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Artificial intelligence, AI, stands at the forefront of technological evolution, with experts predicting that it could add trillions of dollars to our GDP, but it could also negatively impact our workforce and national security. So how do we regulate it without stifling our innovation? Our podcast features insights from various perspectives. We've had industry leaders, to government officials, to leaders of advocacy groups. Together, they address pivotal questions that are needed to create practical legislation. I'm very excited to have Trooper Sanders with us today. He's the CEO of the Benefits Data Trust, which is transforming America's social safety net using data and AI. He's also a member of the White House National Artificial Intelligence Advisory Committee. I invited him on this show as we want to have many different voices that can create practical legislation. And having the voice of a trustworthy AI expert is very important. Welcome, Trooper. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Great, Trooper. To begin with, can you tell our audience what does Benefits Data Trust do for their information?
Sure. In the United States, over the generations, we have created a social safety net where the federal government and in some cases state governments and local provide a range of support to help people meet their healthcare needs, housing needs, food assistance, education, and other things. Benefits Data Trust exists to help connect people who are eligible for benefits, but left to their own devices are not able to apply and navigate the system to those programs. And we also work with public servants and others across the country to help make those systems overall, which represent billions and billions of dollars of spending, make them more efficient, more dignified, more effective, and ensure that our investment in the social safety net can not only improve individual lives, but collectively can make the country stronger, our community stronger because of better outcomes.
So you're performing a very critical function, but Trooper, correct me if I'm wrong, you're using data and AI to do that. It's not just the old-fashioned way, but you're using AI in many ways to do it, right?
Absolutely. So Benefits Data Trust has been around for nearly 20 years, and data analytics, data matching, data sharing, those techniques have been at the foundation of our work from the very beginning. But as the data field has emerged and grown and mature, we've kept pace with that. And so today we are using artificial intelligence in some areas of our work. And perhaps more importantly, we are part of this national conversation and work involving so many others to really figure out what is the role of AI in human services, in helping to provide public benefits, in public service. And I like to say that even those of us who've been involved with data and AI matters for many years and may be an expert in a particular slice, we are all overall students of AI because the space is moving so fast and it is so complicated. So it keeps you humble.
Very important what you're doing, Trooper, especially working with the vulnerable and the marginalized. Trooper, what is your definition for our audience of trustworthy AI and why is it crucial in today's technological landscape?
In many ways, I see trustworthy AI as the output of a lot of processes and work that goes into building and applying AI. So does it have some of the essential components? Is it reliable? Is it aligned to the purpose and for issues around benefits, the public interest purpose? Is it secure? Is it transparent as much as the state of the art allows transparency in AI? Is it explainable? Does it respect privacy? And are there steps built in to mitigate harms? And it is a number of factors that go into a number of ingredients that go into determining whether an AI product or service or application is trustworthy.
So some very critical foundational components, as you said, safety, transparency, that really go towards that. How do you see the role of AI regulation, as we have had an executive order and there's over 100 bills in Congress, but how do you see the role of AI regulation in achieving how you define trustworthy AI, the safety, the transparency, et cetera?
Right. I think regulation overall is essential for technologies and other things that can spread so wide and leave such an imprint, such as artificial intelligence. And it's important for a variety of reasons. I mean, one is certainly to stop and mitigate harm. But also, we should remember that in many cases, regulation enables the marketplace, enables progress to move forward. And then the third part is that ultimately, when we're talking about something that is so powerful as AI, it is important that even though it is part of the private marketplace and business in so many ways, that there is a level of societal and democratic accountability. And that is achieved through regulation, through our democratic process. Now, we do have to recognize that there are certain limitations to regulation, and so it is certainly not a panacea. And so I like to think of it as not a question of whether you regulate or not, because I think the case for regulation in some form is there. But I think it's really a question of regulation plus. And figuring out the plus side is a bit more complicated.
Cooper, just to follow up, you made an excellent point that whether it's not a question of whether to regulate or it should be regulation plus. We've had members of Congress and industry leaders come in and say, we already have got many regulations on the books. You look at FTC from a consumer standpoint, you have the EEOC from hiring standpoint, you have HUD, and you have the NTSA from self-driving cars. Do you think we need additional regulations on top of this? You said regulation plus, so I just want to follow up on that.
Sure. So I would say that I think it is important to remember that when AI is applied in different domains, often those are already well-regulated, deeply regulated domains. And so the question there might be, what tweaks and twists and turns in those existing bodies of regulation need to be adapted to ensure that it is connected and applies to AI? I also think, and this is a sort of a fascinating area for some of the law nerds out there, that how does AI apply to some fundamental areas of the law, such as contract law, tort, intellectual property? And really, it raises some important questions. So for example, in tort law, what does it mean when a harm is created by an autonomous agent that may not have an umbilical cord connected to a human being? We're seeing a lot of the turmoil that's been created around intellectual property and AI. But I do believe that there are certainly a lot of gaps and cracks in the existing body of law where specialized laws and regulations around AI, such as the AI Act in the European Union that has recently been completed, a number of conversations in the United States and other jurisdictions. Now, the challenge is when you're talking about specific pieces of AI legislation, it's quite complicated because AI fits into many cracks and crevices of society, as there are many definitions of AI. And so to write a law around one definition will potentially create gaps in other areas that are very important. And I don't envy lawmakers and others who are involved in this because it is quite complicated. And then finally, and this is why I like to talk about regulation plus, it's just the reality that by definition, you know, the democratic legislative process is a slow and deliberative process. And that means that often the pace of technology's evolution will outpace it. There are some scholars who call it the tortoise and hare problem, where lawmaking is the tortoise, technology is the hare. And you'll often have the case that once a law is in the books, technology has outpaced it. So then you have to try to catch up again. But there are other things that lawmakers have to do. And so in some cases, there will always be a vulnerability around formal law and regulation. And so that's why we need to look at, take a more expansive view and bring in other techniques.
You raised some very interesting points, if I can follow. You talked about the EU AI Act, and then you made a very interesting point that there are some gaps and crises with existing law. The EU AI Act, from what I understand, Rupert, is a kind of goes horizontal across the board. Do you think, because there are industry sectors like healthcare and others, they say, hey, we are unique. We've had experts here come in from healthcare and say, we are unique. So should we have vertical-based laws? That would be my first question compared to horizontal, because you said we have these gaps. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. And there's been a healthy debate between European and American participants in the debate of the European approach, which, as you say, has been this broad horizontal approach versus a more targeted approach. I tend to believe that there may be certain fundamental things that do deserve horizontal regulation. And particularly when you're talking about the use of AI that might be restricted outright, or in some cases banned outright. But then we do have to recognize that, again, the complexity of AI is that there are many definitions, and that AI, it's this constantly evolving amoeba. And so you can't possibly in one text capture everything. And so that's where looking at it in its context of healthcare, where there's a deep and rich body of law and regulation and practice and knowledge around applying technologies and scientific advances in healthcare, may be different than, say, human rights affecting areas such as law enforcement, or rights affecting areas such as the work that Benefits Data Trust does in terms of eligibility for public benefits. And so I think you really are going to need both. And then you're going to need other tools that really bring the social pressure and norms into the overall regulatory context.
You're saying we need maybe a combination of both, but you also said something which I find very interesting, which is AI is like an amoeba, which, as you said, we started even before, but large language models, we now have multimodal, we have agents, super agents, maybe AGI, etc. How is Washington going to keep pace? We don't do things fast here. Forget fast, we don't do things slow here. So the question is, how does legislation or our policymakers, because this is transformative technology, this is not something, okay, that can, fine, we'll get to it when we get to it. Because lawmakers are listening here, their staff is listening. So how do they keep pace here?
Yeah, again, I think we all have to be in student mode. I think a useful lesson is in the United States is the 1996 Telecommunications Act. That was a major piece of legislation. And there was a section of it that's been defined as creating the modern internet. But that took 4 years of very detailed legislative work. And then essentially, the second it was fully enacted, it was out of date, because the Telecom Act really focused on separating long-distance telephone service from local telephone service, and it didn't really account for that the technology had already moved forward. It was already yesterday's news. And so I think now landmark laws like that are important, just like one day we will hopefully have a landmark law in the United States, and other jurisdictions are working on theirs, but it's not sufficient. And so that's where it's both then looking at in the other areas of law and regulation. We reauthorize a major agriculture and food bill routinely, and other forms of legislation that are just part of the normal process, and really making sure that those areas of law and regulation keep pace with AI. Then I think we need to look at things that are under the power of the executive and executive action, and what can be done there. I mean, things like the President Biden's recent executive order on AI that has a force in its own right can move things forward. I think it's important to look at the courts and the various cases and disputes that will be bubbling up through the courts. And those not just in the technical side of AI, but who are about civil rights and human rights and other domains of ensuring that they are participating in those cases, filing those amici briefs and other things to participate in that ongoing dialogue. And then the final area that I think is can sometimes be overlooked is the voluntary space, or what's been called soft law. Things like voluntary principles and codes, norms and expectations, business practices that don't have the force of law, but can often be developed and executed in a more nimble and faster way than traditional law, or certainly things winding its way through the courts, that can also have an effect on steering AI. It's important that we kind of use all of those tools.
I mean, you said some very important things. Obviously, law, then you said executive order is important. Then you also said the courts are going to play a key role. Then you also said voluntary actions. What kind of voluntary actions is it when these, you had all these tech companies come in and they voluntarily promised to do the things? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. So things like that, where the Biden administration had several rounds of commitments from the private sector of actions that they would take. I think also things such as the AI Bill of Rights that came out of the White House, but was expressly not part of the formal regulatory process. The internationally, the OECD, UNESCO, other bodies have created principles and guidelines that don't carry the force of law, but that certainly inform behaviors. And those types of steps are fill an important space to remember when we're talking about sort of lowercase regulation, how to contain and guide behavior. It really exists on three levels. And for some of the law scholars out there, I'm going to butcher the philosopher H.L.A. Hart's work on this. But we have regulation and laws that tell you what you can't do, or you will face a sanction. You can't walk up and punch someone in the face without facing a sanction. But then we also have laws that enable. So the laws that regulate marriage or entering contracts, that is not trying to control us. It's giving us power. It's enabling us to do things. And those are things that you ought to do when you feel like you're going to face a sanction, and other things where you feel you have the power to do. But then when we're talking about soft law, these voluntary initiatives, these are things where you feel like you have an obligation, even when no one's looking, even when you won't face the sanction of the state, but you feel this social pressure to conform because the values have been articulated. There's been a level of buy-in from society and those stakeholders who you care about. And that can help steer behavior as well, and often do it faster than the traditional lawmaking process.
Things you face sanctions on, things you should do, and then the soft side. Just to talk a little bit about the soft side, there are people who are sometimes skeptical, saying, look, what has happened to social media? Our town square is controlled by 5-6 companies. A lot of these companies maybe are thinking of regulatory capture, so to speak. And the fear is the cost of building a large AI model is so expensive that somebody, let's say in a garage in Tennessee or Iowa, probably is going to have a hard time. Are you afraid of something like that? I understand what you're saying is the soft commitments, but.
Yeah, so I think there are certainly areas where only the blunt force of hard law and regulation can address. Issues like competition is really important. Things around, particularly as it affects vulnerable populations, that really you do need the force of human rights law, civil rights law, consumer protection to be there. But those areas are very complicated. It's a very slow process. And so I think you can't just leave it alone to those devices. And so that's where, for example, there are legitimate concerns that you can't rely solely on voluntary measures because it kind of exists slightly outside of the democratic process. But as we know, it is the formal lawmaking process is complicated. It is hard for diverse groups to have their voices heard and to be part of the process. So another channel is through these social norms these voluntary efforts? How do we as a society create the type of pressure and expectation to ensure that the impact of AI aligns with our values and the norms that we have? So it's really about, we need an all-channel approach to AI governance and regulation.
That's a great segue for me to bring up. So, Trooper, as a leader in trustworthy AI, what ethical considerations do you believe are most crucial when you're deploying AI technologies?
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
Sure. I think, first of all, it's the binary of should you or should you not involve and apply AI at all. There are some domains where AI perhaps should not be involved. And I think that is not only a question of there's debate around applying AI to warfare and should there be autonomous weapons or not. That's a binary choice. I think underneath that, there's a real question of even if there's not some clear moral A or AB decision of are the organizations and the systems where the AI is going to be applied, are they ready to manage and guide and control the AI? And so it could very well be that, for example, in the work that Benefits Data Trust does, that there may be many advantages to having AI in public benefits programs to make them more efficient, more precise. But we might find that the administrative and workflow and business process infrastructure isn't ready for the power of AI. And so then there's a question of maybe not forever, no, but not right now. And let's make sure there's a level of readiness. I mean, just like there are many benefits to doing a triathlon, but many of us are not quite ready to compete in one. So we first make sure that we are ready. I think there are other questions around, say, the intersection of ethics and issues such as race and gender. Traditionally, the priorities for traditionally excluded populations, all of those factors need to go in. I sort of see ethics, ethical AI and trustworthy AI as companions, where the ethical piece are all the inputs that should guide decisions, that should be integrated. And then kind of the trustworthy piece is the Lego set of components that you can kind of look under the hood and say like, yep, it has all of these particular components, but it's guided by a sense of ethics.
So it needs to have a strong foundation of ethics. Following up on your point, what measures should we have in place to address concerns relating to bias and fairness in AI systems and to make sure that the benefits are distributed across all socioeconomic groups, Trooper?
Sure. I think on bias and fairness, there's a vast literature and area of expertise around getting under the hood and understanding the provenance and weaknesses and strengths of data sets, of having transparency around what goes in, what is coming out, how to mitigate some of those risks. So I think all of those things are important. But I think it's also important to take a step back and recognize that in most cases, data is merely the reflection of our behaviors and a reflection of what we as a society have decided to allow to happen. And so we will never have the type of optimal data that we need to ensure better AI performance, particularly in areas that affect traditionally excluded and vulnerable populations, until we get to grips with the fundamental unfairness and bias in those systems. So for example, the bias and weaknesses in healthcare data that can lead to poor outcomes when AI is trained on it reflects some fundamental inequities in healthcare. And so while we address the socio-technical concerns of AI in healthcare, we frankly need to turn up the volume on addressing the fundamental inequities in the healthcare system. And there's a great recent essay by Dr. Alondra Nelson, who's like a guru in this space and the author of the AI Bill of Rights and so much more in Foreign Affairs, where she reminds us that we really don't have to accept this choice between unbridled enthusiasm for AI and just sort of being in the depths of despair about the harm. Where there's a third way where this era of AI really gives us the opportunity to fundamentally reconsider and do a new draft for how we want society to work generally. So to go back to the healthcare example, there is an opportunity while we're fine-tuning to get AI's place in healthcare to really go back and ask some fundamental questions. How do we have a more equitable healthcare system overall? How do we ensure that a lot of the racial and gender and other biases that hold health promotion back, not only in the United States, but around the world, is addressed? And then you're bringing in AI into a much stronger, much more equitable system.
Cooper, just do you think AI is shining light on the inherent biases we have, whether it's healthcare, housing, credit, et cetera? Do you think it's doing that, or will it do that? Because you raise a very interesting point.
I think there's the opportunity for it to do that. I don't know if it's fully doing that. And part is, I believe we need to open up the community of people who feel connected to the AI conversation. And I am concerned that we're kind of creating this AI guild that's sort of like the old guilds of hundreds of years ago, where you had a guild for glove makers and another guild for hat makers, and it was meant to kind of restrict things. And right now, I do have a concern that, you know, if you don't have a certain background in engineering or other quantitative disciplines, or I'm glad that there's a lot of social science, particularly in the socio-technical fields, that are involved in AI. But still, again, if you're not a philosopher or a sociologist or anthropologist really steeped in the literature, that somehow you don't have a voice in this. And so I think for us to really be getting to the fundamental issues, we're going to have to make it very clear that everyone has a voice, has a role, has a unique area of expertise in the AI conversation, including and especially the people who are at the sharp edge of being harmed by AI and their experience. And now what that's going to require, not only opening up the tent, but it's going to require those of us who may have found our kind of comfortable niche and area of expertise to get very comfortable with being uncomfortable, because there are going to be voices, perspectives, area of expertise that we're not steeped in. And we're going to all have to figure out how we can integrate these things to move forward.
Some fantastic points, Cooper. I want to just follow up on a couple of things. You said we need to get uncomfortable. We need to get different people. We have a digital divide, so to speak, in this country. What we can't afford is an AI divide that happens. You are part of the National AI Committee. Do you think there are enough voices? I watched the hearings, I watched the listening sessions, and I see a lot of great advocacy groups and others. Are there people from rural communities, community colleges, manufacturing? I mean, what makes our country, Middle America, and all those places, are they represented? Because as you said, this is not a technology that's going to hit 2% or 5%, is going to hit everybody. A rural healthcare system now has an opportunity to get medical help that it never did. A kid in an inner city can get personalized education that they never had. But are we having that conversation with them? This is really a question for you.
It's very important. And I know that I'm really not only honored to be serving on the NIAC, as it's called, but that it's a very interdisciplinary, relatively diverse group of people. Now, there are a finite number of seats around that table, and so there are many gaps. And so I think it's, in terms of the broader conversation, there are more opportunities for voices to be heard, but I think it's really important for us to take affirmative steps to bring in lots of voices, and not only bring them in, but we're also going to need to do the work of engaging and developing the capabilities so that they feel able to join. Because let's face it, if you are, for example, have been spending your time and career organizing for rural maternal health and trying to reduce unnecessary maternal mortality, and you're neck deep in it, you don't necessarily think you are the natural fit for a conversation about algorithms and bias and what I call the world of code. What we have to do is blend the worlds of code and prose and ensure that those who may feel initially, I'm not sure I have a place here, how does philanthropy and others ensure that they can find their place at the table? I also think this is a global question as well, because for all of the work that's going on in the EU and North America and with organizations such as the OECD, that just represents a slice of the global community. And so we also need to pay attention to ensure that all other voices are brought in. And in the being in the United States, where English is our dominant language, we also need to be very cognizant that the scales are tilted heavily towards AI and English. And there are many other languages and data sources in other languages. And so for us to be able to get the greatest benefit, there's a lot of work to be done there.
Yeah. And because we want other cultures, languages, and history that is out there to be represented, because otherwise you'll have all these countries saying, hey, again, this is another technology that is being thrust on us. A lot of work, as you said, that needs to be done. Trooper, what are some of the common misconceptions that you hear about trustworthy AI?
Yes, I think one, that it is sort of a one and done, that you can sort of build the perfect model, wrap around this product offering and ship it out, and that it's great. It's trustworthy AI and you can just put it in and keep going. I sort of think of it as, and sometimes there's a misperception that it's like the seatbelt, where once we sort of figured out that the 3-point seatbelt in modern cars, it's kind of set. Like we may make a few adjustments, but we really haven't said that we had to fundamentally reconsider the design and application of seatbelts. I think with AI, because it is constantly evolving and changing, we're going to have to be much more diligent that what's trustworthy today might not be trustworthy tomorrow. We discover different vulnerabilities, et cetera. And so it's going to be this constant vigilance and engagement. And we need to recognize that may impose certain costs and administrative burdens that we really haven't calculated in. I think the other side is, let's assume that an AI offering is trustworthy by most objective standards. I do think that we have to be careful not to give AI too much power. And so I always worry when people say that AI is replacing human beings. No, AI doesn't think. We have to be careful that we don't give AI human-like characteristics and human-like deference, that it is just a tool. It's a fairly narrow tool, as powerful as it is, that in no way matches the human brain, human judgment, human intuition, human experience. And so when we're applying it, even if it's the best, most ethical, trustworthy, tested product or service out there, we need to treat it as a co-pilot, as a tool. So even today, where, you know, essentially if we get on an aircraft, it can get you around the world with a fraction of the labor that pilots used to have to do. We still need pilots in that seat who are trained in every scenario to make sure that we get there safely. And I think that's the same to keep in mind with AI, no matter how trustworthy it may be.
You touched upon another really important topic, which is workforce. Trooper, there have been all kinds of reports. I mean, you can, whether it's McKinsey, IMF, et cetera, that there will be a mass disruption, especially in white collar jobs. You can take the numbers anywhere that exists. And they're talking about the scale that has not happened before. Does government have a role in this? And what are your thoughts in terms of, people say, hey, we've gone through many different evolutions and we come out ahead, productive gains, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a churn, especially the people who are going out of job. I don't think that's a great message to say, hey, we always come out ahead, don't worry, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think?
Exactly. One of the examples that's often used is we don't really mourn the demise of the buggy whip manufacturer. But what if today that buggy whip manufacturer is a lawyer or a nurse, software developer, reporter?
Customer representative?
Exactly. So I think we really have to balance the macro with the micro. So on the macro level, in terms of overall growth, overall progress in the economy, things may shake out well. But then when we really dig in, and does it shake out well for whom? And who could be left behind. And so that's why I think we really have to make sure we're taking a whole human approach and understanding that it doesn't really matter if you can just say, we won't need this job, but there are 10,000 more jobs over there. Now we have to center the human being. And how long does it take the average person to make that transition? Just from a skill point of view. Now throw in, you have family considerations, economic considerations. The job growth might not be in the area where you live and you have your support system. So it doesn't really help someone in that situation. And that's where I think it really gets back to, we really have the opportunity to totally reconsider what does it mean to encourage progress in the economy, but support people to do it. Yes, training is an important part, but so is understanding the social supports that help people make these transitions. And that's where, for example, the work that Benefits Data Trust does in helping people get public benefits, we do a lot of work with higher education. Because not only do we not want, say, college students or folks going back for their certificate to be hungry unnecessarily, but helping someone access food assistance or ensuring that they have health care for their children and family while they go back to school is a way to help people stay in school, focus on their studies, get that degree, make the pivot and transition that we say people are going to have to do more and more with AI and get ahead. And oh, by the way, in the United States and many other economies, we are in a race for talent. And so helping the mom go back to school because she can get some food assistance and healthcare while she's going back to school and getting her degree, the future of economic growth is dependent upon her getting that degree. And so this is not only the right thing to do, thinking about how we help people transition, it's just good business for the economy, for firms, and for communities.
So what you're saying is that social net and that social ecosystem needs to be also thought through while you're doing the reskilling, et cetera. And I hope people who are listening, people who are working on these important topics, and it's not just the federal government, it's also the state governments who get really involved in this, because we always talk about the federal government, but we have a very important state government system too.
Absolutely. I would challenge the listeners to do a bit of a thought experiment. Think about whatever your domain is. You may be an engineer, a lawyer, whatever it might be. And think about your life right now. Then think about what is the career field that's the polar opposite. If you're a lawyer, what does it mean to become a doctor? If you're a reporter, what might it mean to become a registered nurse or vice versa? And if your job ended today, if your career field evaporated today, how easy would it be for you to jump to the other side? How much time would it take? How much stress would it take? How much sacrifice would it require if you're caring for children and elderly parents? And suddenly you had to up sticks and move. And for those of us who are in more privileged professions, we don't often have to face such an existential question. But certainly, if you are in certain pink collar, blue collar, some white collar domains where the analysis is saying AI will disrupt those areas, that's a real and present concern. And so it's really in all of our interests to ensure that we can have economic growth and dynamism with a humane approach to people making the transitions that they need to make.
You made some scary thoughts. I was thinking of if I had to do something completely, I haven't thought of that. And that's really going out of your comfort zone, but it's a very important thing. I hope all those folks have some voice also as these things are getting figured out. I mean, regulations are important, but I think you make a great point as thinking of societal impacts is very critical. Trooper, this has been fantastic. There's so many, I could go on for at least 3-4 hours more because there's so many other questions. We'll need to have you come back here. But Trooper, as I've told you, who our audience is, if you had some final parting thoughts for members of Congress, staffers, we give a wide platform. We have community college people, manufacturing, we have Mid-America, education, we've had all kinds of people here because all the voices are needed. So this is your chance to talk to them.
So I would say, number one, you have a lot of work ahead. It is supposed to be daunting. I would also say that I think we've done a good job of bringing the technologist into the ring. But I would sort of challenge everyone who creates the tables where decisions are debated and made to both ensure that you bring the affected people into the room, bring the workers into the room, bring the skilled professions into the room, bring the people who need to receive government benefits into the room. Hear their perspective. What do they need? Bring the frontline workers who, for example, public service workers who know best how AI can make our public benefit system more effective and efficient. Bring them into the room. Center them. And then second, I would say, again, bridge the worlds of code and prose. The engineers are great. The technologists are great. But frankly, bring in the sociologists, the anthropologists, the philosophers, the social workers, and others who understand the broader social dynamics and how communities work. Bring in that local city council member, because they're going to bring a richness to your conversation and to your decision making. And that's really important to get this right.
Oh, bring the affected people. I hope people are listening. Affected to the table. Bring the sociologists, the anthropologists. Not just the technologists, not just the computer programmers. Very well said, Trooper. Thank you so much. As I said, I've learned a lot. This has been fantastic. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.